Well, of course, much of what I have said depends upon you accepting the tapes as being the authentic original tapes. That is the basis upon which they are permitted in evidence, members of the jury. Tapes are not permitted in evidence in a court of law unless they are authentic originals. And if you are not satisfied that these tapes are the authentic original tapes, then it would be your duty, no doubt, you'll be directed upon this by the learned judge, to forget about what you heard. Were they, are they the authentic originals or not? Yes, says Mr. Perry, says Mr. Lloyd, says Mr. Mounter, says Mr. Hawkey, and to an extent says Miss Millard. No, says the defendant. They're all fabricated. Or rather, he suggests that they're all fabricated. Do you realise, members of the jury, that after all this time, there isn't one single scrap of worthwhile evidence in this case that any of those tapes have been fabricated? Consider the defendant's case, members of the jury. The tapes are fabricated. But do you know that in the 4 weeks that you have been thus far listening to the case, the only specific suggestion for fabrication that has been put forward by the defendant is that somewhere or other there is missing the fact that he'd spotted a photographer? That's the only direct specific suggestion of fabrication in relation to any one of these tapes. To be fair, members of the jury, he's also said that he never accepted any money. And so I suppose it's implicit, is it not, that he is saying that all the references to money must also be fabricated. He has suggested that the reporters may have had some hand in this. At the last count, it was Mr. Moody who was responsible for fabricating the evidence. Well, I think we can deal with this quite briefly and in stages. Could the police be responsible for fabricating the tapes? Answer, no, they can't be responsible for fabricating the tapes. There are many references to money on the Times transcripts that were prepared before the police ever laid their hands on these tapes. And members of the jury, I'm not going to take you to the references, but may I just give you the page numbers if you care to have them. So far as the Times transcripts are concerned, you will find references to money on pages 1, 3, 5, 8, 11, 12, 15, 12, 15, 17, 18, 21 and 25. Mr. Ford has told you that he's listened to the Times copy tapes and that they're exactly the same as the ones that we've got in court. The Times copy tapes were prepared on the 2nd and, I think, the 2nd and 5th of December of 1969, although I can guarantee I should be corrected if I'm wrong. Before the police got their hands on these, there's no question of the police having fabricated them. Mr. Lambert, Fred Lambert, you'll probably remember all that business the other day with Mr. Lambert, when you went away at the end of the evening and he listened to all the tapes. Have these tapes been tampered with since he first listened to them? Very shortly after they came into police custody. No. Absolute rubbish, he says. And so, members of the jury, that knocks the bottom, doesn't it, out of the defence that the police have, in some way, fabricated these tapes. And what's left, then? The reporters. They say no, they haven't. You've heard them give evidence over a long period of time. It's for you to judge whether they were telling you the truth or not. Mr. Hawkey said, no, those tapes have not been fabricated. I listened to them straight away after they were played. Miss Millard said, in so many words, didn't she, members of the jury, although she didn't actually hear the tapes played before us, that when she listened to them, she heard corruption. Mr. Hyde, the expert, the speech expert, in his opinion, it's impossible that these tapes could have been fabricated. He said you can only edit conversations between two people under favourable conditions, and here we haven't got favourable conditions. We've got motor cars going by in the background, all the background noise. We've got two people sometimes speaking at one and the same time. And if you choose to listen to these tapes again, you will hear members of the jury how, when they're talking about money, how close their voices are together, sometimes overlapping. Impossible, says Mr. Hyde. Well, Mr. Killick won't go that far, but Mr. Killick said, do you not remember? It's very difficult to believe, very difficult to believe that any of these conversations have been fabricated. And insofar as he is able to help, Mr. Hales, who was the boss at Location Sound Facilities, said no. No question of any jiggery-pokery going on in my place during this time. There's overwhelming evidence, members of the jury, that these tapes are the authentic originals. And so what does it boil down to? Well, I'll tell you what it boils down to from the defendant's point of view. It boils down to this. This is the proposition. One, he says there is evidence that the tapes used were factory fresh. Two, there is scientific evidence that three of the tapes were not factory fresh when they were put on the spools. Therefore, three, the tapes are copies and are unreliable. And what I'd like to do, members of the jury, is to deal with that, if I may. Do you remember that the other day I said that I'm looking forward to the opportunity of reminding you what the evidence actually is on this topic? Well, this is my chance to do that, members of the jury. May I say, by way of preface, that I accept that Mr. Hawkey did say, originally, that he had always used factory fresh tapes, and in making the point that he did, the defendant is absolutely right. He's making a perfectly good, perfectly fair point. And I think it's right to say that the defendant pointed out to the reporters that, or one of them, was at one stage, he had said that they'd used new tapes. And in making that point, he's doing no more than he's fully entitled to, drawing to your attention a perfectly fair, reasonable point. But just let's consider what the evidence actually was. Mr. Lloyd, members of the jury, said with reference to exhibit number one, I don't know if a new tape was used. With reference to tape number three, the batteries had run down on the ewer and therefore the recording was useless as far as we were concerned. Tape three would have gone back to Hawkey and he used it again. Tape 5. I can't remember if this was a new tape. That's Lloyd. Mountain. This is what he said. At the beginning, Hawkey did not appear to be properly equipped. In the early days, he didn't bring enough tapes. Fairly early on, we made it clear that he must come with batteries and new tapes. And he said the same sort of thing about the marking of these boxes and spools. He said this, nobody devised early on a foolproof system of marking. It developed later on. It was important that one of us could identify the tapes. I couldn't see any possibility of a mix-up. And so Mr. Mounter was making it perfectly clear that in the early days they weren't adopting such a strictly controlled system that they devised as time went on. And the tapes that the defendant criticises here are tapes numbers 1, 3 and 5, and members of the jury, they are early days. The very first day was the 28th of October, the second one, the 31st, was only 2 or 3 days later. Let me remind you of what Mr. Hawkey had to say. He said this, tape number 3, that is the original tape, which was used, and he had it in his hand, which was used for phone calls. And you remember that there are some phone calls on the back of this tape. They are just recordings of telephone calls. The rest of the tape should be virgin. It's still a new tape as such if you use one half and the second half hasn't been used. Well, that might be a rather naive statement of fact, but that was his reaction to the cross-examination. And he said about tape number 3, it would be quite normal to use the tape for the telephone conversation in the morning and the incident in the afternoon, and more than one meeting or incident would be recorded on one tape. And members of the jury, this is what else Mr. Hawkey had to say about this. When he was asked, why did you use start 3B immediately after 3A? His answer was, no particular reason, convenience, I should think. And it was put to him that it wasn't, that 3B wasn't recorded on a factory fresh tape. And he said this, I didn't realise it. It's pure accident that we overran a conversation with another officer. We all have accidents. And members of the jury, in relation to tape number 5, this is what Mr. Hawkey said. Tape 5 has two different conversations. I would say that there's a recording being made and over-recorded. If it was done, it was pure accident. And in answer to the learned judge, he said, I would say that the quality would be unaffected. The point of that is this, members of the jury, and you remember that Mr. Hawkey insisted that these tapes were the originals and just those that he'd heard at the time. If the truth of the matter had been that Hawkey only ever used factory fresh tapes, when this was pointed out to him, he would have had no explanation. He would have had to have said, wouldn't he? Well, that's odd. These tapes can't be the originals now. But he didn't. He said, no, these are the originals. I heard them. I saw them being marked up. And if they're not, if they weren't factory fresh when those recordings were made, why then I must have used the same tape again. It was a pure accident. There's been a great deal of to-do about this particular topic in this case, members of the jury. I have sought to remind you of what the evidence actually was about this topic, and I hope that having done so, that will assist you in arriving at a conclusion. The boxes and the spools and the batch numbers, they are points for the defendant to make. He has made them, they are fair points for him to make. Please consider them, members of the jury. But it hardly bespeaks, does it, some vast conspiracy when we do find one or two spools in the wrong boxes. It doesn't suggest, does it, that some evil genius has got down to spending time to concoct the whole thing. There's more than one tape in relation to the events of the 31st and the 21st. And you know from the expert evidence that the noise levels on those tapes are entirely consistent with the microphones being positioned in different places. Well now, Mr. Lloyd referred to that policy as belts and braces, more than one tape of the same conversation. It hasn't, unhappily, afforded the reporters an escape route from cross-examination that all of these things were fabricated. affected because you may think it doesn't matter how many recordings they've made of this particular conversation or these conversations, they'd still be criticised uphill and down there. But what are you going to believe about it? That whereas it would have been so easily for some this evil genius to put in one tape for each conversation, he's gone and made life 10 times more difficult for himself by putting 2 tapes in or 3 tapes in, and made life 20 times more difficult for himself by trying to fabricate the different noise levels on the different tapes. Just doesn't begin to make sense, does it, Holmes of the Jury? Another point, and that's this. Do you remember those little snatches of conversation at the end of these tapes? When, after the conversations are finished, and when the motor car's arrived at its destination, and there's a little bit of chat between the reporters and Perry and Hawkey. Well, what kind of evil genius is it, Mr. Jerry, who would present fabricated tapes and leave stuff like that in? Mr. Mounter said, look, I'm not particularly proud that I used such language when certain words were put to him by the defendant, but we left everything in. There was to be no editing out. I wouldn't have anyone touch the tapes under any circumstances. And so it is, members of the jury, that left on the tapes we have the bits and pieces of conversation to which you've listened. The leaders weren't marked, criticises the defendant. So what? If the leaders had been marked, he'd have only said that they had been fabricated. I mean, it's a no-win situation, isn't it? You just can't win. And who is said to have done all this fabricating? Well, members of the jury, I've already dealt with that. And finally, on the question of the tapes, this missing tape X that the defendant talks about, you know, the one on the 21st, the mobile that was in the motor car, and the Nabra that was in Hawkey's motor car. Hawkey has looked at his original schedule, Lloyd has, Mounter. They all there see what they wrote in 1969. This recording didn't come out. And the defendant shows you where the box, Exhibit 44, with Mobile to Nabra crossed out. And he says, there must have been another tape. Why he says it, goodness only knows, but he does. He says there must have been another tape. And, what's more, that is the clue to the whole case, because if only we had that tape, why, we'd see what the truth of this case was. Well, members of the jury, we've got 3 already at that meeting. And there is an absolutely cast-iron reason for the fact that you haven't got 4, namely that the one in the mobile didn't come out. And you actually hear Hawking say, at the end of tape 13, that it had to come out. Now, members of the jury, I'm going to come on, finally, to the 4 days with which we are most closely concerned in this case. The 24th of September, 28th of October, the 31st and the 23rd. And I know that you must be feeling terribly weary by now, and I know that this is probably the first day of spring, or first worthwhile day you've got, and so I'll do my best to cut it short. But you know, this case has gone on for week after week after week, and it's rather important. And it's rather important that I should draw certain matters to your attention. The 24th, members of the jury. The 24th was the day of that meeting between the 2 men in the cell below. Perry has given you evidence as to what happened at that meeting. The defendant seeks to brush the whole thing aside. It's all sorts of nonsense. Do you think that this was the favour I was going to do for you? Do you think this was worth any money and the like? Let me deal with that. One of the most notorious cases in our criminal law is a case in which a Lord Chancellor, no less, was prosecuted for corruption. A very great Lord Chancellor, Bacon, who was sitting in judgment in the case, and one of the litigants, members of the jury, gave him a bribe to decide the case in his favour. And Lord Chancellor Bacon decided the case. And he decided the case against the litigant who'd given him a bribe. And the litigant, you might think, was rather upset about this. And he went and spilled the beans. Lord Chancellor Bacon was convicted of accepting a corrupt payment, even though he'd done nothing. Even though not merely had he done nothing, but he decided the case against the man who'd given him the corrupt payment. Why? Because, members of the jury, it's what's going on in the mind of the person who accepts the payment that matters. And if you know that you're receiving a payment you shouldn't, a corrupt payment, you're guilty. And it doesn't matter whether you seriously intend to do anything for it, whether you believe that you can do something for it or not. It doesn't matter, tuppence. That was my submission to you at the beginning of the case, and I repeat that to you now. The defendant said, through Fred Lambert, you know, if I was corrupt, then the Nuneaton officers were corrupt. And members of the jury, if the Nuneaton officers had had anything on Perry, had any worthwhile evidence against the man, that might have been so. But the defendant knew that they hadn't. And the defendant knew that he wasn't going to have to do anything to persuade the Nuneaton officers to drop the charge against Perry. The defendant had already tipped Perry off to say nothing. And once given that tip-off, members of the jury, Perry's no fool. He said nothing. That was it. The next thing that happened was that the defendant very quickly learned a letter went on its way to Perry saying that he wasn't going to be prosecuted. There is no need to involve the Nuneaton officers in corruption in this case at all. And the defendant knew it. Perry was seen by the defendant at Camberwell, members of the jury. Why? Why did the defendant ask to go and see him? Well, says the defendant, do you think that I would have been having words like this with Perry? After all, he was the likely lad. I was out to get him. I was out to have him arrested. That, members of the jury, you know, is one of the basic flaws of what he said to you, and one of the evils of the offence of corruption. That if you're involved in corruption, you can play both ends against the middle. On the one hand, there are fellow officers in your force who believe that you're striving to get the perfect. On the other hand, there's the criminal himself who knows that you're giving him help. What happened in that police cell? Well, just think about it, members of the jury. When Perry was cross-examined about this, he told you, he gave you his version as to what happened. And you remember how he insisted that he'd use that word if. If they've got a fingerprint on you, then plead guilty. And how the defendant insisted to him, no, the word if wasn't there. What had been said was, they've got a fingerprint on you, plead guilty to section one theft. When the defendant was interviewed by the police about this, this is what he was asked, members of the jury, page 327. And, you know, the police put to the defendant the defendant's version of what had happened, not Perry's, because what happened was quite clearly this, that the typewritten copy of Perry's statement didn't include the if.
Did you say to Perry, I don't think they've got a lot on you. They won't tell me a lot. They've got a fingerprint of yours. Tell them you'll plead guilty to section one. One theft. The most you'll get is 12 months for that. Definitely not, said the defendant to the police. The exact opposite of that which he was putting to Perry when Perry gave evidence about this matter. What did he see him about? Didn't spend any time, did he, trying to get an admission from him? Didn't spend any time interviewing him about the clothes that had been found in Perry's flat, or the knives that were there, or the belt croppers that were there. It was a 2 minute, perhaps 30 second conversation between the two of them. What did he say to him, and what did he have in mind? The defendant will say, well, all very improbable, as you know. But there's an easy answer to that one, members of the jury, and I'm afraid that it goes back to the defendant's own words. I'm in a little firm in a firm. And you may think, members of the jury, that in a business such as this, it takes one to know one. And the defendant has sized up the situation very nicely for himself. The favour, said Mr. Perry when he was cross-examined by the defendant, was they didn't think that they'd got a lot on me, but if they have a fingerprint on me, plead guilty to section one theft and you'll only get 12 months. Now, members of the jury, if I may have permitted another idiosyncratic expression, a nod is as good as a wink. And somebody like Perry, who's told something like that, knows perfectly well what the score is. You remember James giving evidence about this. You remember yesterday Officer Clarkson giving evidence about it. One thing that a police officer would never, ever do is to even hint to a chap who's under suspicion that they've got nothing on him. Because if they do, they'll just clamp up immediately. The defendant was giving him a tip-off. It wasn't worth £200. Perry didn't think that it was worth £200. The defendant's big mistake was that he thought he could get £200. He got £150. The Nuneaton officers say that Mr. Perry was interviewed about it the following day and said nothing. The defendant makes a very valid point, perfectly proper and fair point. He says, look at the record here, there's nothing to the effect that Perry was interviewed the following day at the Nuneaton police station. And you give due weight to that point. In fact, members of the jury, give due weight to any proper, fair point. But those Nuneaton officers all say that he was interviewed several times, not just once, but several times the following day. What did Perry say about this? And there's no motive for him to have said it. In all my dealings with the police, he said, I've never been questioned more than I was there. I must have been questioned a dozen times. We know, members of the jury, that those Nuneaton officers were very surprised indeed that they got no admissions from Perry. We know how upset they were. We know from them, do we not, of the conversations with the defendant afterwards, when the defendant was interested to know if they knew who this Metropolitan officer was who told him to say nothing. We know that the defendant said that he didn't want Robson to know that he, the defendant, knew about it. Why? What was it all about? There was a favour, members of the jury. You may or may not think that it was worth £200. With great respect, that doesn't matter. The fact is that the defendant was prepared to ask for £200. And the fact is that the defendant got £150 of that £200. Can I come to the specific offences and just say two things to you about them, and that is, first, what the evidence is, and second, what the corroboration is that we say is before you, which is capable of supporting Perry's evidence. Perry says that money was paid each time to the defendant. Is there any evidence capable of corroborating that? In our submission, there could hardly be better corroboration. The corroboration comes in the following forms, members of the jury, I would respectfully submit to you. First, the searchings of Perry before and afterwards. The evidence there from Mr. Lloyd, Mr. Mounter, and Mr. Hawkey. Then the evidence of the tapes. And there can be no better support for a man's evidence, can there? But the fact that the conversations were actually recorded. Can I just pause there to say this, members of the jury? It's a matter that may I know not please Mr. Ford and Mr. Killick. They say, well, you know, in our opinion, we wouldn't allow tape recordings to go before a jury in a criminal case. Certainly Mr. Ford holds that view. Well, they are admissible in law before a jury if they're properly proved. And you know, members of the jury, there's no such thing in this world as evidence that cannot be fixed or rigged. But there's a very serious move afoot at the present time to ensure that all interviews with defendants are tape recorded, so that it can't be said that police officers are putting words into the mouths of people who are being interviewed. So that in relation to tape recordings, we're likely to hear a good deal more of those than a good deal less, which will keep Mr. Ford and Mr. Killick busy for a few years, won't it? The fact is that any evidence brought before a court, any evidence, can be fabricated, can be tampered with. There's no such thing as evidence that can't be. What you as a jury have to do is to consider the nature and quality of the evidence that proves the tapes, and to decide whether you can accept it or not as being reliable. Tape 5, page 7, Mr. Jerry. Tape 5, page 7. Corroboration of count number one, top of the page. You know a bit more, dear. See, more, dear. I see. That's Perry. A bit more, dear. That's corroboration of the fact that there'd already been some dear. His words aren't corroboration or capable of being corroboration. It's the defendant's reaction to it that is, members of the jury. Yeah. It's the assent, it's the agreement by the defendant, it's his reaction. And those words are also, in my submission, capable of corroborating count number two. Page 15, please. Perry. I still ain't got it all yet. I got another 50, all right. Now, this is on the 31st, members of the jury. And Perry said that there'd already been one payment of 50 on the 28th. The defendant's reaction, yeah, fine, yeah. And in our submission to you, in our respectful submission to you, because it's the judge who will tell you what evidence is capable of amounting to corroboration, the defendant's reaction to that, yeah, fine, yeah, is capable of amounting to not merely corroboration, but overwhelming corroboration of Perry's evidence. both in relation to count numbers 1 and 2. In relation to count number 1, it's that word another that you see there, members of the jury. Count number 3, page 19. Bottom of the page. This is still on the 31st, but just look what appears here. I'll get it. I'm definitely going to get it next week, but I couldn't get my hammers on. Talking about more money that's to come. Page 22 on page 14. All right there, I ain't got a, actually, I only got 50, all right. Pardon? I'd only got 50 again, all right, yeah. That yeah, members of the jury, is an answer machine capable of amounting to very powerful corroboration of Perry's evidence. And indeed, members of the jury, what more could one possibly wish for? Can you imagine for one moment what would have been said about these conversations with Perry if we hadn't got these tape recordings? Page 24, bottom of the page. Perry told you that he could hear the words, "Here's the other thing, I can't get fuck all lately." According to Mr. Penner and Mr. Ely, yeah, here you are, I may as well give you that now. I can't get fuck all lately. Well, you decide what you can hear on these tapes, members of the jury. If you can hear reference to money there, further corroboration. Page 36. Bottom of the page. Anyway, Mick, thanks very much for that. In our submission, evidence which is clearly capable of corroborating the defendant, Perry's account of what happened. Is there anything else that's relevant on these counts? Well, yes, of course, members of the jury, did the diary, isn't there? Shall we just concentrate on those 3 dates now? The 28th. On the 28th, say the prosecution, the defendant is very nicely and very neatly fudging it. "2 p.m. Deception, re-Oppenheim inquiry, and engaged until return to MC at 5:15 to Edmund Street, re-inquiry." What inquiry? I've already gone through this. He wasn't meeting an informant, according to him. What inquiry was he engaged on at Edmund Street? No reference, you'll note, members of the jury, there, to the fact that it was the Rose. And may I tell you that in all of these pages here, there are 15 references to the Rose public house and one to the grave on other days. Let's look at the 31st, shall we? 2:45. 2 p.m. sorry. Remember that the meeting was at 2:30. 2 p.m. meal. 2:45 to MC High Street, re-inquire and return to MC at 3 p.m. The 21st of November. And remember that the meeting was at 2:30. 12 noon. To West Dulwich re-inquiry and return to MC, that's home base at Camberwell. To return to MC at 12:30 meal. There's no such thing. And the defendant asked, as he was entitled to, some of his fellow officers, did you ever know that I was corrupt? Or did you ever think that I was being corrupt? No, they said. He wasn't doing too badly in his own records, was he, when he was here, when it came to hiding what he was doing in these three rather important moments of time.
I'd
say, Your Honour, that they are capable of amounting to corroboration if the jury took the view that the prosecution was likely to take about it. Of course, if they don't, if they think they were innocent or maybe innocent, why then, of course, they wouldn't regard these as being capable of corroboration. And so, members of the jury, may I tell you, I've nearly done. What is left to the defendant, and what has been left to him in this case, in the face of such evidence? Well, it's time for Big Crown to call a spade. What has been left to him? In the first place, it's been left to him, has it not, to throw as much dirt as he possibly could during the course of this case, in the hope that some of it might stick. The following people have been accused of dishonesty: Mr. Perry, Mr. Lloyd, Mr. Mounter, Dean Uneaton officers, and Mr. Moody. And by a side wind, the following people have been accused of dishonesty: Brennan, a question mark over Hawkey, and Lord Thompson. Mr. Lloyd, he came in for a bit of a battering, didn't he, members of the jury? More than once. Now, the defendant may well not like Mr. Lloyd, because Mr. Lloyd, after all, started this thing going. But he said a great many things to Mr. Lloyd, and fairly early on in his evidence, he put it to him that, you remember that he had a history of mental disorder and had been mentally deranged. Absolute nonsense, said Mr. Lloyd. An evil suggestion. There was a great deal about that when the learned judge said to the defendant, you know, I hope we're going to hear some evidence about this if it's true. We are, said the defendant. Have you heard of members of the jury? Mr. Lloyd, you may think, was goaded by the defendant. He rose to the bait, it's fair to say, but he was goaded by the defendant. Mr. Mounter, you were more interested, said the defendant, in writing scandalous stories than in bringing a corrupt police officer to justice. Do you remember, Mr. Mounter? Could you really imagine a more impressive witness? The Nuneaton officers were accused of dishonesty. Mr. Moody was. The defendant tackled Mr. Moody in a rather clever way. Do you remember this? During the first part of Mr. Moody's evidence, Mr. Moody was asked a whole series of questions about other people's conduct, as if he were some expert from on high who could help the court about the conduct of other people in the case. And do you remember him saying, when he was asked about the control exercised by the reporters on the various exhibits, well, he said the control devised by the reporters wasn't what I would have expected from the police, but it was adequate. A whole series of questions, and then, just towards the end of his cross-examination, when the defendant had been able to extract as much out of him as he possibly could, he accused him of fabricating everything. What a business. What a business. Well, Mr. Moody, members of the jury, it would seem, is not merely responsible for fabricating much of the evidence in this case in some way, but he's also responsible for the fact that shortly before his trial was due to start, Mr. Simons left the country and wasn't seen again for a number of years. It seems that Mr. Moody has even got to bear the blame for that. What else has been suggested? That the reporters were acting as agents provocateurs. Nonsense, members of the jury. That question doesn't even arise in this case. Do you remember what Mr. Mounter said? Throughout the investigation, we were very careful not in any way to be Ashen provocative. We were careful not to give Perry any money. We didn't want to be accused of influencing him. What's all that about, that suggestion? Is it designed to make you believe that in some way the reporters were responsible for all of this? What a twisted situation it would be for the jury if you came to the conclusion that that was so. They didn't seek out Mr. Perry. Mr. Perry sought out Mr. Brenner, who sought out them. And you may think from what little you've heard about the Robson-Harris matter that Mr. Perry was in pretty desperate straits when he did. And finally, the absolute last resort, although unhappily it's been resorted to on a number of occasions, I haven't had a fair trial. How many times have we heard in this case? How many times have we heard? It's a cover-up. I haven't had a fair trial. It's a farce. Well, I'm very pleased indeed to say that I don't have to make any comment about that, because you, gentlemen, have been here during the course of this trial. And you've been able to see with your own eyes and hear with your own ears whether this defendant has had a fair trial or not. All that I propose to say about it is that it's, in our submission, the absolute last resort of a guilty man who can think of no other way to secure his acquittal but to persuade his judges, namely you, that he's not getting a fair trial. The defendant said to you, members of the jury, on Monday of this week, I think it was, you know, I've worked it all out. I said this to you in so many words. I've worked it all out. I've done 18 months of my sentence in real terms. I'm not worried about my sentence. Just worried about a criminal conviction being recorded against me. A matter of principle. Well, members of the jury, there it is. That's what he says to you. There's only one thing in this case that counts, and that's the truth. And in our submission, if one considers the evidence in this case, it takes you to the truth. And the truth of this matter is, and it's as much a matter of principle, I suppose, the other side, as a matter of truth, is that the defendant was a corrupt police officer, and that the prosecution asked you to say so in the verdicts that you return on the charges in this case.